We've got a lot to cover, obviously, this morning. This is not a short chapter. It's a pretty long chapter, so we'll get going. Have you noticed that there's a lot of anger around these days? Just drive. You'll find it. And there is. In fact, anger probably right now is not the primary emotion. It's derivative. It's brought about by frustration, worry, a lot of other things, but it comes out looking like anger. But it's out there, and it's pretty palpable right now. Psychologists tell us that they are dealing with it more than ever. Our daughter works in the mental health field, and she tells Leslie and I that everything people came in with before COVID has only been exacerbated by the fact. So if she is dealing with a depressed person, she's now dealing with a more depressed person. If she's dealing with an angry person, she's now dealing with a more angry person. That's what has happened over the last year. We see a king today, the most powerful guy on earth, getting angry. And when a king with that kind of power gets angry, some bad stuff can happen. But we also see somebody who knew his God, who is able to respond to the anger pretty well. There's so much going on in Daniel chapter 2. We can't begin to come to the end of it. We'll try to get a few things done here today. So, the sermon today, here's what it's about. Human history will play out with various powers dominating at different times, but they will all be replaced finally by God's everlasting kingdom. This is the God who knows you and your place in the story. Here's what we're going to try to accomplish today: to expose the limits of our human power and control, so that we will have proper fear and respect for the power and the ultimate triumph of the living God. Now, in that passage that Leonard read, there is a key phrase, I think a key verse, and that's in tip my hat to old age here. Here we go. All right. That's in verse 34, and it says this: "And as you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them to pieces. Then the iron and clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold, all together were broken in pieces and became like chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." So that's the key verse, and understand this: the statues, it represents all the kingdoms, the stone cut without human hands, that means by God, comes down and smashes the whole thing and sets it up. I want you to think of this just for a moment. Just as the kingdoms that are prophesied here, just as Babylon was a literal kingdom, so the rest will be literal, including the final one, that's established by God. All right, so what are some lessons from Daniel chapter 2 that we can take home with us today that will be some help? Well, first of all, and I think perhaps most importantly, is this: human power, philosophy, and spirituality will eventually fail you. If you haven't found that out yet in life, it's time to learn. It'll fail you. We are limited in so many ways. It takes place, this does, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar. That means that Daniel is still young, probably still a teenager. Nebuchadnezzar, most powerful man on earth, had dreams. God is starting to break through to him. And he either dreamed this more than once or perhaps just once, but his sleep left him. And so he did what any ruler of that time would do. He had a dream. He believes the supernatural is whoever it is. The gods are trying to get his attention, so he calls in those who are supposed to have access to the gods to tell him what's going on. And so he does. He calls in the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans. Now, those are four different terms. A lot of times they are used interchangeably. The first one, the magicians, probably has to do with divination, for telling the future by revealing unknown things through supernatural means. Others specialize in interpreting dreams. Some specialized in communicating with the dead. They were all advanced in the learning of the day. And we were told in chapter 1 that Daniel, Hananiah, and Mishael, and Azariah took the same classes as these guys. And not only did they pass, all of these classes. They excelled. Now, they were studying things that if they had studied it in Judah, they could have been killed for. This is the kind of stuff that God said, I don't want you guys to have anything to do with. Isn't it interesting, though, that when they're transported from Judah, a kingdom that was supposed to represent God, into a secular world, Daniel pleads for these guys' lives later on. Interesting, isn't it? Had they been there, they'd have been subject to being killed. Here, Daniel doesn't expect them to know better, so to speak. So they took the classes, they passed them, they excelled, but there's no indication that Daniel and his friends did this kind of thing. It's kind of like, you know, when I took a class in biology when I was in high school and college, what did they tell me? They told me the earth is a gazillion years old and it was formed over time and we evolved. All right, now I could still, I didn't get an A, but I did pass it, which meant at some point I had to tell the teacher what teacher wanted to hear, right? Didn't mean I had to swallow the whole thing, hook, line, and sinker, and believe in it. You see, we can pass classes and not do it, just like a lot of people pass ethics classes and are not ethical. So these guys are called in by Nebuchadnezzar, and then when they come in and they begin to talk to him, the text changes from Hebrew, the language of the Jews, to Aramaic, the language of the Babylonians, or the lingua franca of the day. And it stays in Aramaic all the way up and through the beginning of chapter 9. Now, I think there's some reason for this, because we're dealing with a period of time that Jesus in the book of Luke calls the time of the Gentiles. And it's written in a language for these Gentiles who would be reading it later on could understand. So it begins the Aramaic section. And the guys come in, they say to Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Tell your servants a dream and we will show you the interpretation, which was what they expected. What does Nebuchadnezzar do? No, you tell me the dream. Now some commentators think he forgot the dream. I don't think he forgot the dream. I think this dream was too hardwired into his brain for him to forget it. He knew exactly what he had dreamed, and he didn't trust these guys. So here's what they say to him. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand, for no great powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. And Nebuchadnezzar is saying, that's the point, guys. If the gods are giving me this dream and you represent the gods, then tell me what's going on. Now again, the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, he was young. Daniel and the other guys were young. And it seems clear from this entire context that Nebuchadnezzar was not willing to accept an easy interpretation of his dreams because they troubled him so much. It really messed him up for a while. So he wanted to make sure that what he was hearing from these guys was the truth, because he suspected that they might just be making it all up. Anyone can interpret a dream, right? Say what you think the dream means. But if you can tell me what I dreamed, then I'll trust your interpretation. In other words, show me you really are connected to the gods. Show me you really are connected to the supernatural realm. I will believe you if you can tell me the dream, because that's what I know. And if you can tell me what I know and what I think you don't know, then it's going to show me something. Now, before we get all self-righteous with these wise men who couldn't live up and they couldn't deliver the supernatural goods to Nebuchadnezzar, let's just stop for a moment. In his book, The Logic of God by Ravi Zacharias, he tells of a conversation he had with a Hindu man who was insisting that there was nothing supernatural about Christian conversion. He said that it was nothing more than a decision to lead a more ethical life. Then the man said something that was truly profound and should make us all stop and think before we talk. The man said this: if this conversion is truly supernatural, why is it not more evident in the lives of so many Christians I know? That's a pretty good question, isn't it? Troubling question, isn't it? Now, how do we know? How do we show we're truly connected to God? How do we show we have some access into the supernatural? Jesus tells us how, and it's not what we might expect it to be. He said in John 13, 34 through 35, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another." Now, to see this love that is supernatural, people need to be up close. I put in the little email I wrote, they need to be welcomed in before they believe, because this is the way they come to believe, according to Jesus. If they see the kind of love we have for each other and for them, and they see the kind of love that the Kirbys are talking about, you have to be up close. A lot of times our problem has been that we don't invite people in until they believe. What Jesus is suggesting is to let them in before they believe, and then they're going to see something, and they'll know that our faith, that our conversion is more than just trying to be a more ethical person. There's something deeply supernatural about it. So what has happened is that Nebuchadnezzar, for all of his power and influence, was met with something he could not solve. Have you ever been there? He's the most powerful guy on earth. He had unlimited resources, but he has stopped short. His resources ran short. His wise men were unable to tell him the dream. In the book of Ecclesiastes, which I would not advise you to read if you're depressed, starts out this way. "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does a man gain by all the toil that he does under the sun?" Then he goes to answer it very long in several chapters. And it's not a peppy uppy. If you're writing music from this, it would be a dirge. It'd be a lament. "Vanity means futility, emptiness, pointlessness, worthlessness, insignificance, and hollowness." What he's telling us is that the world is bankrupt, and the religions of the world offer false hope, and that's where Nebuchadnezzar was. So he has a dream. He's young still, doesn't trust these older advisors. He calls on the resident experts in such matters, and they can't come through with an interpretation. If they were really legit, they'd be able to tell him the dream first, but they can't do that. And so they swung and missed. So now a frustrated, absolute monarch gets really, really mad. And that leads us to the second point today. Human weakness leads to irrational and destructive solutions to human problems, or I could say human rage, which is what Nebuchadnezzar happened to him. Here's what happened. Because of this, what's this? Well, this is his frustration at them not being able to tell him what the dream was. "The king was angry and very furious and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them." All right. Angry because of what? Well, because the so-called wise men who were supposed to have the divine insight that came from the gods admitted that they didn't have this insight. In other words, they really didn't have access to the gods or the supernatural. So Nebuchadnezzar was left to think that either the gods were stupid or those who said they spoke for the gods were stupid. So they failed to do the very thing they were supposed to be good at. The question here is whether he starts to kill the wise men right away or only starts to round them up. So he's very impulsive, and this leads to a very destructive decision. Let's kill them all. He doesn't stop to think of the ramifications, and in fact, he doesn't stop to reason at all. You ever make decisions in anger? Let me ask you this, as I ask myself. How many decisions have you made while in anger that you look back on years later and said, that was a really good decision? That worked really well. Maybe a couple, but probably not too many. More likely, more likely we regret some of those. Cato the Elder said, anger opens the mouth and shuts the eyes. A Chinese proverb says, it is easier to swallow angry words than have to eat them. Proverbs 14:29 says, he who is slow to anger has great understanding. So you get the picture. I'm sure that a lot of us have regrets. And again, psychologists are telling us that anger is just so prevalent out there today. There's a lot of destruction going on in homes, behind the scenes. People are angry at one another because of the situation. A lot of times, and anger is such a complex thing, a lot of times it gets displaced. Dads, have you ever had this, that you're working all day and you've had a bad day and you come home and one of your kids does a really minor infraction and you just jump all over them? Because you're really not mad at them, you're mad at something else, and so you displace the anger and put it on them because they're small and it's easy. That's what anger does. It's irrational when it becomes like that, and it is destructive to no end. So Nebuchadnezzar didn't slow down. He was frustrated and he vented, and so he sends the goons out to find out all the wise men of Babylon and to round them up, and eventually they get to Daniel. So here's the third point. Through faith and prayer, God's people receive God's answers. So starting at verse 14, then Daniel went to his house. Oh, I'm sorry, I jumped ahead. So this one I don't have up there. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill all the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree of the king so urgent? Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. So first of all, you should note that since all this happened in Nebuchadnezzar's second year, as I've said, Daniel was still a teenager. His life had just been through. I mean, they came to round him up. He's doomed, right? Somehow he has the cool to be able to talk to Arioch, and kind of between the lines here, Arioch must have liked him because he listens to him. He doesn't just shut him up and say, get in the wagon. He actually listens to him. So he sent out, the text says that Daniel found out about this, and he answered with prudence and discretion. Prudence is the idea of offering wise counsel, and discretion has to do with tasting or discernment. So you put those two words together, and the idea is that Daniel responded again in good taste. Remember last week in chapter 1 when he made a suggestion? He made a request rather than going in demand. And in a sense, he does the same thing here. He properly analyzed the situation and responded accordingly. He responded in a way that was more likely to get what he was trying to get at. By the way, when we respond in anger, we're almost guaranteed to not get what we really want. Nebuchadnezzar really wanted his dream interpreted, and he does the very thing in his anger that is going to mean he's not going to get his dream interpreted by killing anyone who might be able to tell him. Daniel responds just the opposite. So much so that Arioch listened to him. And then a series of miracles, I think, happens. What's not really said here is that Arioch must have listened to Daniel. Daniel must have made a request to go in to see Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel goes in to see Nebuchadnezzar, and he asks for time. Now, Nebuchadnezzar was not willing to give the other wise men time. But Daniel kind of said the magic words, look, king, I think I'll be able to tell you your dream. So if you just give me a little bit of time, I'll do it. And the king relents, his anger is assuaged, and he goes. And so then what happens? Here's what happens next. And Daniel went into his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. That's their Jewish names. His companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of the God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of our fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might and have made known to me what we ask of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. What a great passage, and really what a great scene. Daniel goes back to his apartment that he's sharing with his buddies, and he doesn't say, okay, we got to kill a goat and examine the liver. He doesn't say, get some tea leaves, pour tea, and let's see what shape is made on the cup after we're all done drinking. He doesn't go into a chant. In other words, he doesn't use any of the devices he'd been taught in Babylon. He goes to his faith. He said, guys, we got to pray. Our lives truly, have you ever prayed like your life depends on it? I can think of it two or three times in my life that it seemed like my life depended on it. It was praying. It's pretty intense, right? And that was Daniel at that time. His lives and the lives of his friends depended upon this. He tells them to seek mercy from the God of heaven. That's an interesting phrase. It's saying, you know, he's a merciful God. We know that about him. We don't deserve this, but let's ask him for mercy. To the God of heaven. Now, that's a key phrase here, the God of heaven, not the God of the heavens. That is to distinguish God, Yahweh, between the Babylonian heaven gods, the moon, the stars, the various heavenly bodies that they worshipped. This is the God who made them. Secondly, it is the God who dwells in heaven. He doesn't necessarily just dwell in the Jewish temple, which they superstitiously thought that as long as the temple existed, they couldn't be beaten because that's God's home, even though God said, yeah, I'll hang out there, but that's not where I live. So again, please understand, these guys are teenagers. At some point during their prayer, God makes a dream known to Daniel, and he calls it a vision of the night, and he was wide awake. So the great confidence Daniel had in God here was he goes to Nebuchadnezzar and says, I think I'm going to be able to tell you the dream. He gets the time he needs, and he prays. And then he prays out, and we find some great things about God in his prayer as Daniel prays them. I'll just refer you to it. So Daniel goes to Arioch, the guy who was going to kill Daniel, and all the other wise men, tells them that the riddle is solved. Arioch goes into Nebuchadnezzar and takes maximum credit. He says, I have found among the exiles of Judah a man who will make the dream known to the king, as if, you know, Arioch had something to do with that. Okay, so here's what happens. God reveals through Daniel the big picture of human history and God's plan to redeem it. Nebuchadnezzar was the most powerful man on the face of the earth. God is making known to him through this dream what's going to happen with human history and how human history is going to end. I mean, this is like a big picture story, right? It is a meta-narrative that God is giving to Nebuchadnezzar. I'm going to read verses 26 through 30 and then jump to 37 through 45 because I have some cool pictures to show you. So here's what happened. The king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream that I've seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered the king and said, no wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in bed are these. To you, O king, as you lay in bed, came thoughts of what would be after this. And he who reveals mysteries made known to you what is to be. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar went to bed. He's a young man. He's thinking things. How long is my kingdom going to be? How long am I going to be in this? What's going to happen after I die? So he's thinking about bigger things as he falls asleep. And then he has this dream. Daniel says this, but as for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because of any wisdom that I have more than all of the living, but in order that the interpretation may be made known to the king and that you may know the thoughts of your mind. And then verses 31 through 36 basically are the content of the dream. Now, I apologize for this picture. I didn't draw it. Have you ever, just go do a Google search and say image of Daniel chapter 2. And you'll find a lot of kind of ridiculous looking things. Here's what I found. All right, that's the image of Daniel chapter 2. I don't know if he was walking or, you know, what it was, but it's, you know, it's not bad. Guy's buffed. All right. So that's the image. So you see the image, head of gold, silver, bronze, iron. You can't really see it, but the, you know, the toes and the feet, admixture of iron and clay. And then you see this ball of fire coming down from a mountain, and it's about to do this and totally destroy the image at its feet. That's where we get the term feet of clay, by the way. And then the stone became a mountain that filled the whole earth. That's Thousand Island Lakes up in the Eastern Sierra. And this is in Canada. Aren't those beautiful? A lot better than an image. Okay. Stone became a mountain that filled the whole earth. So Daniel then goes and says, "You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given power and might and the glory, and into whose hand he has given wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, making you rule over them all. You are the head of gold." I don't think Nebuchadnezzar heard anything else after that. All right? So you're the head of gold. Nebuchadnezzar probably heard this, blah, 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 after Daniel said that. So, you're the head of gold. "Another kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you, and yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things, and like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all of these. And as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom, and some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay. And the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom that shall be partly strong and partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdoms be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke to pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this." And I love this last line. "The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure." Thank you, 16-year-old Daniel. So what's going on here? Well, obviously we don't have time to get into a lot of details here, but what are the kingdoms of Daniel chapter 2? Now here's what I think. All right, here's what most dispensational commentators would tell you. Those who believe that Daniel is written in the 6th century and that he was foretelling this stuff. The head of gold is clearly Babylon. Silver chest and arms, Media and Persia, the kingdom that was come after. The bronze, middle, and thighs, Greece. Iron, legs, Rome. We can identify those. Where we get into trouble here is at the end, the feet and the toes. We can't identify that from anywhere in history yet. But there it is. All right? So, but I think it's safe to say, just as those four were literal, the last is going to be literal too. All right. Daniel 7, we got the same kingdoms going on, only different images. We have the lion with eagle's wings then, transformed to a man. That's Babylon, and I think Nebuchadnezzar. Because Daniel 7 is kind of a repeat of Daniel 2, only with different images. We have a bear raised up on one side, chewing on three bones, which I think represents the Media-Persia Empire. And then we have a leopard with four wings, just as Alexander went really quick and conquered the empire. And then it has four heads. He died. And four kingdoms came up in Alexander's place during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, which we're going to get to not today, but later. That's Greece, the Greece Empire. And then finally, terrifying and dreadful beast with iron teeth, and that's Rome. And 10 horns of the fourth beast. That's in Daniel chapter 7, future kingdom with some continuity to Rome. There's a little horn in Daniel 7, a future leader, probably the Antichrist, the beast of Revelation 9, 11 through 19. The Son of Man, in that equals Jesus from Revelation 19 and 20. All right, Daniel chapter 8, we have the ram and the goat representing Media, Persia, and Greece. All right, so that's what's going on in a big picture. And again, we don't have time to get to the details, but Nebuchadnezzar is getting the picture of world history in an image. The God of world history, and don't lose the big message for the details here. The God of world history is saying to Nebuchadnezzar in this dream, there's going to be kingdoms, they're going to be set up, people will rule them, but there's going to be a last kingdom that's not going to be passed on to anyone. It's going to be eternal, and it's going to be supernatural. It's going to be divine. A hand, a stone cut out without human hands is going to come and crush all of the rest of them. So that is basically the content of the dream and the interpretations, the interpretation of the dream. All of that, the world kingdoms come to an end suddenly and decisively, and it's all over until Jesus sets up his kingdom. All right. God protects his people while they're in exile. This is the final point. Verse 47. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel and commanded that an offering and incense be offered to him. The king answered and said to Daniel, truly, your God is God of gods and Lord of lords and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery. Then the king gave Daniel high honors and many great gifts and made him rule over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. I'm sure they enjoyed that. Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel remained in the king's court. So here's this Jewish kid, deported from Judah to Babylon, and now, as a teenager, he is like second in charge of Babylon. Amazing. God is caring for his people while they are in exile. He is not going to let them be destroyed while they are in exile. He still has plans for them. And even though they're living now in a very strange world, he is going to take care of them. My friends, he's going to take care of you and I. We're living in times we don't understand. We've probably never been as uncomfortable as we've been over the last year. Things do seem to be going from bad to worse in so many ways in terms of the death. Here's what's happened. We are in the final death throes, if it hasn't happened already, of Christendom. Do you know what Christendom is? Christendom is the influence of Christianity upon cultures. Now, that hasn't always been a good thing. Most of it has been good, but there's been an awful lot of bad things done in the name of Christ by people who really don't believe in him, and yet they've had power, and they're, quote, in a Christian culture. Well, that culture is now either dying or it's died already. I kind of think it's died already. And those of us who grew up at the end of that culture are very uncomfortable all the time now because the culture we love, the nation that we love, we see it drifting and drifting and drifting, and that is sad. It's bad news. I'm not here to say that's wonderful. But what it does do is this. It gives us opportunity like never before to shine on this black backdrop. Have you ever been, some of you maybe are rich enough to go to the jewelers? And when the jeweler pulls out a diamond, what does the jeweler do? There's light shining from above, but the jeweler sets the diamond against a, what color background? Black. Why? Because it shows off the diamond. Just as Daniel and his friends were shown off by God in Babylon, and we see all the contrasting attitudes that Daniel had when compared with Nebuchadnezzar and to some of the other people that he was around. The difference was qualitative. People noticed. Jesus said, "They will know that you are my disciples by the way you love one another." That is our opportunity during this time and this place, and we can be assured that just like Daniel and his friends living in a culture they didn't fully understand and probably did not like, yet they knew enough about God to live in it as lights. So the next step for us today is this. God is great. Therefore, we do not need to be in control. He knows your place. He knows the big picture, right? But he knows your place in the big picture. So my invitation to myself and you today is to find your hope, your rest, and your peace in him. Don't look for it anywhere else. You'll be disappointed. It won't happen. Jesus said this, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Let not your hearts be troubled, neither let them be afraid." Let's pray as the band comes up. Lord, thank you for Daniel chapter 2. It tells us that you are fully in control. And since you are fully in control, and you know the end from the beginning, and you know how kingdoms of this world are going to play out, and you are going to come, Jesus, you are going to come, just as sure as there have been earthly kingdoms, you are going to come and set up a kingdom every bit as real as the ones that came before, only your kingdom will have no end. It will go from here into eternity. And so, Lord Jesus, it only makes sense to us today to put our full trust in you and to live right now in our context as people who love you so that those who are around us can get in on what we have. It was never to be kept to ourselves. And so, Lord, help us to show the people around us that we truly do have access to the supernatural by the way we love one another, and by the way we love them. In your name we pray. Amen.